just before we get into this week's episode, Stephanie, you had a special message.
Yeah, I realized that it's our 100th episode and I thought we should do something to mark it because I'm not about to burst into song, but I do have this kind of song in the back of my head where it's like, so glad we made it, look how far we come. So I'm just really amazed that we arrived at 100 episodes and I wanted to thank everybody who got here with us.
Yeah, I think we've actually done, you know, far more than that because we also have episodes that aren't what we describe as full episodes. They're more kind of bitty ones. But this is really a milestone because that means that 100 times people have given up their precious time to explain something in depth to us. And I'd just say, you know, thank you to everybody in the community who's bothered to answer the emails and rocked up to Zoom or when we've recorded in person in Humanity Hub. You know, thanks.
Yeah, and not only the people who spoke up to talk to us, but also the people who tune in and listen and plug us on all kinds of social media channels. I still find it wild that I occasionally get recognized by voice from the podcast. I have to admit that this mainly at super niche international justice events, but it's still, it's really, really heartwarming to know that so many people follow this. And I especially also liked that the 100th episode was with someone who we've also seen through the years at international justice meetings, Mazen Darwish, who we also kind of have been following over the years, who is now one of the Secretary Generals of FEDH and came to talk to us about universal jurisdiction, which also took years to mature. So I feel it's kind of a companion journey to the podcast. So enjoy this episode and thank you everybody so much for supporting us and listening to us.
From the state side, this is practical tools to do something, not only say to do.
Medieval crimes are being committed.
I come with clean hands.
Victims of horrific crimes want justice.
We don't have anything better than this.
This is Asymmetrical Haircuts, your international justice podcast, with Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg. This episode was produced in partnership with justiceinfo.net.
All rise.
Hi, Steph.
Hi, Janet.
So it's that time of year again. It's not only spring, it's also the Universal Jurisdiction Annual Review. Thank you to the NGOs who gather the data. And a basic summary could be that there are kind of more countries than ever before where crimes were committed, where their nationals are being put on trial. But there's still a very narrow group of many European countries who are actually practicing UJ. We're going to say universal jurisdiction as UJ, I think, through the podcast.
Well, there are 36 new investigations opened worldwide in 2023 and 16 convictions. Only 13 domestic jurisdictions currently have extraterritorial cases or UJ cases.
And joining us is Mazen Darwish, a Syrian lawyer, journalist, human rights defender, president of the Syrian Center for Media and Freedom of Expression, also Secretary General of the French-based rights organization FIDH, or FIDH, which is one of the organizations behind this annual report. That's along with Trials, Civitas Maxima, Center for Justice and Accountability, ECHR, and Redress.
So let's start, Mazen, with a very basic question. How would you explain UJ? And I came across this just recently because I had to write a story about the Argentinian case that was filed by a Ukrainian victim yesterday, and I had to have it in one sentence in the text. So now let's hear the expert of how I should have described it and not how Reuters simplified it.
Good morning. UJ, it's one of the tools, it's very important tools, and especially this period where many victims in many countries, they can't access to the international justice or even for domestic justice. So for us, it's one of the, yes, alternative choices, but it's a very powerful also tools. And we see how from Syria to Ukraine, all these victims who cannot reach justice and accountability in their country work together with the INGO to raise these issues, to keep the file of the justice on the table. And in many cases, it give answer for the victim, some justice. We see that how a lot of these cases, there is suspect was arrested and in victim. And also there is many needs. It's not only, again, about the verdict. This is not a revenge tool, but also it's tools for the victim to say, this is what happened. This is true. This is how we also preserve the narrative. We see in Syria, by example, for the victim of the chemical weapons, how the Russian tried to change the narrative when they reoccupied the Eastern Ghouta in 2018. They brought some of those victims and the doctors make a lot of pressure. They bring them here to The Hague and make a press conference, say, this is fake, nothing happened. We fake these videos and these things. So when we have a verdict from a court, professional, independent court, testing the evidence, collecting all a story and say, this has happened, this is true, this is mean a lot for the victim, not only the verdict itself, even in the cases where we don't have suspect in custody. Still, it's very important.
But like legally, how would we describe it? What I described it as is that it is a mechanism that allows countries to try for the worst crimes, so crimes against humanity, war crimes and genocide usually, or crimes that were committed outside of their territory and by people that have no links or are not nationals of their territory. And it comes in different guises. Some need links, some don't. But as a lawyer, how would you describe the mechanism that allows this to happen?
Look, if we look at it from the country side, this is the state responsibility from one side, even if this crime doesn't happen in their territory. But this is the responsibility from this state for this kind of international crime. And this is also how we make this value and goodwilling and good statement, put it in a practical way. It's not enough to say that we are against war crime or crime against humanity and do nothing, just statement. So this is, from the state side, this is practical tools to do something, not only say, to do. From the victim side, this is, again, maybe not the best choice. Maybe this is not the first option they have. For sure, me, myself, and as one of those victims, I prefer to see transitional justice model in my country, in Syria, to see these cases and court, not in Koblenz, not in Paris or in The Hague, to see it in Damascus. But as we can't reach this now, this is important for us as a victim, as I said, to keep this file on the table, to not allow to the lord of the war and their supporter, regional and international power, to go to any political agreement without take care of the victim needs. For these countries who have this kind of conflict, and through now in Syria, by example, more than 12 years, and it's become a civil war. So we can't guarantee sustainable peace without guarantee the satisfaction of the victim.
Do you think there are enough countries practicing UJ, Mazen? I mean, kind of the base is mainly Europe. Steph just mentioned Argentina at the start, and we know that they're involved. They have got a very activist prosecutor there, so they're involved in a number of things. But basically, it's Europe, isn't it? I mean, do you think there should be more countries doing this?
Yes, indeed. Even inside Europe, we need to see more countries involved. There is a need for change the jurisdiction even to allow this kind of cases and make the victim can be able to access to justice in this country. This is in Europe, but also everywhere. Latin America, Africa, and the global south specifically, where the majority of the victim coming. So we need to make this movement universal movement, truly universal jurisdiction, not European jurisdiction. And we are happy, glad that the increasing of the number of the cases, but also we need to push for changing the legislation.
Is that where you think the biggest barrier is, that countries are not set up with the right legislation for it, or is it a lack of expertise?
Let me say, to reach this point about the expertise and the logistic need, we need to have our open windows for those victims. If the legislation not allow victim to access, so no need to speak about anything. So first of all, we need to break this wall. We need law, allow victim to access to justice, and then we can see what the need, the expertise, the role of NGO, the role of the victim themselves. Yes, it's not an easy thing to prosecute a crime happened abroad, and especially that in the majority of these cases, war crime unit cannot access to the crime scene. So yes, there is a lot of difficulty, but we need to be sure that all state take this responsibility in a practical way, and we can find solution for the needs.
Even in the states that have these universal jurisdiction cases, you see there are barriers for victims, and there's a lot of talk about victim-centric processes. How would you assess that going? I know in France, NGOs can be party to cases and victims can be party to cases, but that's not everywhere. What's the model and what do victims really need in these cases?
Yeah, one of the important things, victims need dignity and respect. And for this, yes, we need to see more involvement from the civil society. War crime unit, the police, focusing maybe about the security issue. And this is right and needed everywhere. Me as one of those refugees here in Europe, I will be happy if the police do their best against extremism, also fighting ISIS or Al-Qaeda. This is, we can do it in several ways. There is no one way to do this. So also for this reason, we want to see more involvement from the civil society who can make balance between the security need and the victim need, and who can also link between this jurisdiction and the victim and the crime scene itself. Those who know the culture, the local sensitive, the local law, and know the contents and what happened exactly. This kind of cooperation between the war crime unit and the NGOs, the only way to guarantee that we will have dignity and respect for the victim and justice and security and safe society for the country who host those refugee or society.
We recently had the head of the IIIM, Catherine Macuel, on the pods. They're the investigative mechanism into Syria. And they seem to be quite proud of the way that they've been working with civil society. I mean, is that an example of civil society being part of the process? What's it really like, Mazen, from your point of view?
Yeah, this is one of the good examples, the IIIM and Judge Catherine Marchioil. And let me say hi and thank you for all her wonderful effort, especially that she leaving now, end of the April, the IIIM. Look, I think we met even in New York when they appointed from the Secretary General in 2016, before even her first day in Geneva. And she have this vision from the day zero that this is will never happen without a cooperation between the UN mechanism and the civil society. And if we want now to see how much war crime unit or even IIIM or COI, by example, the number of evidence and testimony they have it coming from civil society, believe me, it's more than 80%. So this is show that when this mechanism, if it's local or from the UN side, while they can't access the country, the crime scene, so they need the civil society. Professional, also independent civil society can fill this gap and can be guaranteed that this process will succeed. Without the work from civil society, believe me, neither the IIIM or many of these war crime unit and cases in Europe will never be happened.
And you talked there about the COI, so for all of those who are not into all the Syria accountability acronyms, that is the UN Commission of Inquiry on Syria. In the Universal Jurisdiction Report, it includes 49 cases underway in 9 prosecuting countries for international crimes committed in Syria and bordering Iraq since 2011. Germany has always been lauded as a big example. What are the other countries kind of getting into this prosecution of Syria crimes now? What do you see on the horizon?
Look, in general, yes, Germany, France, Netherlands, and Sweden. Maybe this is, and now Belgium, it's on board also. So maybe this country, the majority of the cases, it's coming here. Some of these countries, unfortunately, as you mentioned also, legally they give more space for civil society. And this is also why we see, by example, in France, the majority of the cases and the number coming from France, because the French legislation gives the civil society and the victim this position as a civil party in the case, so they are part from the process and they are partner in this legal process. They are not information provider or some decoration. We need them just to say, hey, we have a Syrian or a local victim. Every time there is more cooperation and partnership between the civil society and the legislation, Germany, one of these examples, Netherlands, now after also many years of building trust and work step by step, even with the police and war crime unit, they, I think, recognize finally that they can do it by themselves. Some of these country, by example, in SCM, we receive every year between 35 and 45 demand from war crime unit in Europe and America, asking evidence, information about suspect. This is not the same way in 2016 and 17, where a lot of these unit, they feel confused about how they should deal with civil society. And also, they don't know exactly if this is, will be good for the cases or this is, will harm the case and the victim rights. But slowly, year after year, case after case, step by step, we find now the majority of these war crime unit deal in official way. Now we receive official demand, legal demand from this war crime unit about information. Some countries still, they prefer to do it in an official way, sometimes in personal way, just by email. Hi, is there any information about this? But we know this is could be changed and should be changed. But now I believe that we reach this level that they can bring the meaning of these cases, the meaning of justice, bring it to the victim. And they can do it in better way, more than the war crime unit and the jurisdiction in any country. This is also very important. We need to not forget that justice, it's about human.
Can I ask if we can take a quick look at a couple of processes to do with the very top of the regime in Syria and the Assad family itself? First one, just to ask for how you feel about what's happened in Switzerland, because there was an international arrest warrant against Rifat al-Assad, which was 10 years after the first criminal complaint was filed against him. And he then went back to Syria, as far as I understand. So, you know, there's really no chance to put him on trial. I mean, how does that make you feel?
Look, yeah, we can keep talking about a lot of failure also, not only good and wonderful example. We have a lot of a problem, a lot of failure. This is maybe one of these cases. Yeah, it's disappointment for the victim, for the Syrian, for me also, who working in this case. But also it shows that more than 10 years and the victim and their representative Syrian civil society with the Trial International, how they keep pushing and keep fighting. They never say that we are tired or we will not keep working. So 10 years, and in the end, yes, indeed, after Rifat go to Syria, and we don't think that Bashar al-Assad will send him in a plane to the court. But in the same time, if I want to compare what happened in Switzerland about Rifat al-Assad and the chemical weapon case in France regarding Maher and Bashar al-Assad, so it shows that it's link. Maybe we will have delay, failure in one case, in one country, but also we have another success, and this is all linked together. So this is a one movement.
And we were talking about the second Assad case in France, which is actually targeting President Bashar al-Assad, connecting to the chemical weapons, and we still plan to do a whole different episode on that, but that French case seems very ambitious. How on earth will the French court prosecute a sitting president?
Off record, I can say more.
Do you think you will see that in your lifetime?
Yeah, why not? Look, I was yesterday, I'm talking with a colleague from Bogota, and I told her in 2004, we in FIDH, we have our conference, it should be in Bogota in 2004, and the president in that time decided that a human rights defender the enemy. He go on TV and say they are the enemy, and we were in the hotel, and the tanks surrounded us, and we just evacuation from Bogota under fire, honestly. And now he's in custody in the prison, and he's waiting the verdict from the court. Yes, in 2004, maybe I never thinking that this is will happen, but this is true. This has happened. So yeah, justice take time and need a lot of effort. And sometimes it take verdict. This is also what happened in Argentina. See how the mother of the disappearance, how they keep fighting 20 years to broke the amnesty and bring back the voice of those disappeared to justice again. To be also honest and realistic, yes, I believe that I will see it. Maybe it will take 20, 30 years, but this is will happen.
And I'm wondering where you might also see some other opportunities, Mazen. I'm wondering whether we're likely to see more trials which involve corporate actors in related to atrocity crimes. I know that we've already seen the start of some cases, but is this an area that you're focusing on?
Yeah, this is part from our strategy to have many cases in different countries. Again, we're working to make universal jurisdiction a movement. So it's not something, let me say, something just reaction. If we have here or a victim or here a possibility. So yes, maybe yesterday you saw this case in Argentina, and I'm happy that even the legal advisor in this case for the Ukrainian, he's a Syrian lawyer. And he benefited from this work in universal jurisdiction from the Syrian civil society. And this is how we make it movement. This is what the meaning of movement. It's not about Syrian or Ukrainian or any other. It's about how we can give tools to the victim and how we can make also all this good speech or goodwilling coming from state real, practical. Maybe, yes, in the UK, soon we will have some good news, finally, after years also in fighting there. But hopefully also more cases in Argentina and even in African country.
That was going to be exciting.
Pourquoi pas?
When we talk about gaps in these universal jurisdiction cases and the kind of things they prosecute, we had
people on the podcast when we're talking about ISIS prosecutions, that a lot of people get prosecuted for membership of a terrorist organization, but not for things like sexual and gender-based violence or enforced disappearance. Is that something you're trying to get more on the menu for UJ cases to also look at?
Yeah, when we are talking about the UJ, we are 10 years now, maybe 20, 15 years of working specifically, last 5 years maybe the most. So we are talking in the first step. And yeah, there is a lot of need. And again, this does not mean that international justice should not be also exist and have their rule, or domestic justice. But this is how we can make all these elements work together for all the victims, especially, yes, the sexual abuses and the women's and gender right, because in many of these countries, they still, the legislation, but also the sometimes the culture doesn't accept this kind of cases. And for the women's specifically, it's hard. They are not fighting only the criminal, but also society and the stigma, and sometimes the family. So we need to have also safe place for those kind of victim, so we can raise this kind of crime and guarantee the safety of those victim. This is honestly, even we start in this in Syria, but directly we find that sometimes the family itself, the society, need to protect the victim from the family. This is maybe in the first steps. So maybe we take back one steps and try to build more safe environment for the victim before we go to prosecute this kind of crime.
And Stephanie just mentioned enforced disappearance as one of the elements that might need more work on. And we know that there's a new UN body which has been created on looking into or supporting the efforts to find out what's happened to the disappeared in Syria. What are your hopes for that body?
I think this is one of the also very important example how the victim, when they can't access the justice domestically or even with the UN itself, we need to remember that there is 18 veto time coming from Russia and China against things related to Syria. Justice and accountability part from this. So even though the victim keep fighting for their rights, and in the end, like what happened in the trouble IM, even when it's blocked from the Security Council, they go to the General Assembly and they achieve this trouble IM and IIMP. So this is also, again, an example. I think it's linked also to the same strategy when we are talking about UJ, universal jurisdiction. When it's a block where it seems that we can't do anything, we can find alternative choices, but we need to keep pushing, keep trying, keep fighting inside the system and outside the system. So the new mechanism, honestly, huge succeed. I still remember I write the first non-paper to the UN, and in that time I was very angry. What's the meaning of non-paper? It's a paper. It's my paper that my colleague, my friend, my family, they are disappeared. What's the meaning of non-paper? And they okay, this is an expression in the UN. So it's don't worry about white paper, non-paper, this kind of things. I said, okay, but this is paper. This is our paper. I said, okay. This is an example. But from 2016 until 2023, the victim, the civil society, then the victim association, who start working and organize in 2017 and 18, they make this difference. They make, for the first time, there is a UN mechanism it's their responsibility, the faith of the missing people in Syria. And this is important for the victim, but also this is, we feel it's more fair for us as a human rights defender and a civil society. One of our projects is very known, the VDC, Violation Documentation Center, and we have more than 100,000 names of missing person in Syria. So we feel it's not fair to keep this responsibility in our shoulders as a human rights defender or as a civil society. For many reasons, now 13 years, we keep update and upgrade and try to make this documentation in best way. But we can't do it forever. It's need a lot, a huge effort and logistic and money. And this is, yes, the UN responsibility. And they should do it, not push it and keep it in the civil society shoulder. So even if just now we can guarantee that maybe after 1 year, 2 years, we will have good documentation about the missing people, collect all of these data from the family, from the civil society, from the victim association, and reserve it. This is huge succeed, because this is also what we learn from what happened in 1982 in Hama. There is more than 16,000 person missing until now, and unfortunately, maybe we don't have even their name. Now we can say this is the responsibility of the IIMP and the UN, and this is the right of the family, so they can go to specific address. They knew now where they should go and who they should ask. And the Syrian government and also Qassad and the opposition and all of those de facto power, this is a chance for peaceful future in Syria. This is not only about the missing person and the family, but this is also could be the first practical steps to find solution for one of the most important problematic rights in Syria. I hope, and maybe this is something crazy or unrealistic, but I hope that they will take their responsibility and thinking in the long term. If we don't have solution, if they don't cooperate, this means that we will repair the country for another war, and it will be totally civil society, and it will be totally about revenge and about the lack of justice and accountability.
We always end the podcast with asymmetrical haircuts, questions that you haven't prepared for. But I know you're a lawyer by training, and I think one of our first questions is, do you have a favorite court case that you like to talk about or that you worked on that is important to you, you know, the kind of thing that you tell people at dinner parties or that you impress on students or colleagues as an example of something that you do?
Well, the favorite crime, the favorite violation, I happy or war crime, which war crime you prefer than the crime of movement? I'm just joking. But yeah, this is also true. This is part from the story. Look, maybe the first case, not only because this is the first, but it's about the SCM team. And for me, it's very important because the victim themselves, who led the process, who go and give their testimony and evidence, and it's give hope even for the other victim, that the victim themselves, they also have responsibility and the duty. And if they don't do it by themselves, so no one will do it. The first case, the first arrest warranty in coming from this case against Jamil Hassan, maybe Yara, my wife, still feel impressing when I get the news. We were in the supermarket and I start dancing. And I said, okay, this is not my husband. I don't know him. He came alone. And this is maybe, it's mean a lot. Maybe it's not the most important legal case. Many other cases, it's better. And maybe this is not the best case for me as a lawyer also. We learn a lot. I'm happy, glad that SCM have their even own cases without any international body. So we reach this level. The beginning, always first step, first case, it's more difficult, more complicated, more emotional, because we're working about our torture, our disappearance. It's not something happened in other country or other people. It's us also. So it's very emotional, very complicated situation to be victim and lawyer in the same time, to be professional and fit the legal narrow and control your emotion. But yeah, I think this case, it's the best one.
And the other question that we always like to ask at the end, is there anything you'd like to share for the audience that you are reading or listening to or watching? It can be something related to your work or it can be something completely not related to your work. I mean, whatever's on your Netflix queue that you'd like to share with people.
Yeah, I'll say that I'm working with my colleague about with some family of the victim of the immigrant road and the Mediterranean Sea. And one of the sister make a film about her sister called My Maysoon, Maysoonati. And honestly, it's for me, it very important that all of us to see it. Even I consider myself expert in this field, or I know a lot, but it's very inside film. And every time the victim themselves express their feeling, say their word, it's make added value. So yeah, maybe this film, and hopefully we can find some answer for Hadil, the sister of Maysoon, and a lot, hundreds and thousands of the missing people in the immigrant road.
Thank you so much, Mazen, for taking time out of your schedule in The Hague to come in to chat to Steph here at Humanity Hub. Well, I'm on the other side of the screen.
This was Asymmetrical Haircuts, your international justice podcast, created and presented by Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg. This episode was produced in partnership with justiceinfo.net, an independent site covering justice effort for mass violence. This episode was recorded at the Hague Humanity Hub, home to a community of innovators in the field of peace, justice development, and humanitarian action. Music is by audionautics.com. And you can find show notes and everything about the podcast on asymmetricalhaircuts.com. This show is available on every major podcast service, so please subscribe, give us a rating, and spread the word.